Hello, welcome to Pharma Marketing Talk. This is your host, Pharma Guy, also known as John Mack. And today my guest is Thomas P. Stossel, MD, who has just written a new book called Pharmaphobia. And the subtitle is How the Conflict of Interest Myth Undermines American Medical Innovation. And I'm very happy to have Dr. Stossel here. He's a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research, but he's probably done a lot of other things that you might be interested in learning about. So why don't I let Dr. Stossel talk a little bit about his background. Dr. Stossel, can I call you Tom?
You certainly can, John, and thanks for having me. I like to say I have two day jobs and three night jobs. My one day job is I'm a physician, as you mentioned. I'm a blood specialist, hematologist, and ever since I left medical school, I've seen patients, mostly inpatients in the hospital setting. And then my second day job for many, many years has been basic research on how your cells crawl, and I've had quite a bit of success at that. But during the first third of my career, I was vaguely aware that medicine was getting much better, but I was aware that it was because of the improved tools, drugs, and devices that we had. But as far as I knew, they came from Santa Claus. And I also have to say that all that research I did, nobody lived one day longer or better because of it. And then in the late 1980s, I was invited to join the scientific advisory board of Biogen. And that's when I realized how clueless I had been and got me into my first night job, which was trying to commercialize discoveries I'd made in my research that I previously just didn't know how to do. And I also came to realize how difficult it is, how expensive, and how fundamentally honorable people in business are. So that first night job. Then timing is everything. And just as I got into that position, what I call the conflict of interest mania appeared. And it was based on some incidents that had to do with corporate-sponsored research, which we can talk more about. But what they were saying, that industry is corrupt and corrupts physicians and researchers, just was inconsistent with what I saw as reality. And I was fascinated with this, and I read all the material. And so for 15 years, I just annoyed my friends and family. And then starting about a decade ago, I started writing and speaking about it. And things went from bad to worse, and I decided it's really complicated. It's lots of material. People are really not even intelligent, well-educated people, even doctors, don't understand how innovation works and that how wrong some of these ideas that go under the code name conflict of interest are. So I wrote this book. And I just, for completeness, my third night job is my wife and I. My wife's a dentist. We have a nonprofit. We go to Zambia. I'm the only hematologist who's done thousands of fluoride varnish treatments, and we've reduced the cavity rate in a large urban orphanage in Zambia and a remote rural village just in our 10 years we've been going there.
Wow, you certainly have covered a lot of territory there, but unfortunately,
it's
we have
because
to
I flunked administration. I'm so bad at politics that nobody wants me. I don't have to go to meetings all day.
Yeah, that's probably a good way to improve your productivity. So let's focus on this conflict of interest. I mean, you use several terms in the book. I love your terminology. It's just very emotional. Like, you talk about the conflict of interest myth, and you also refer to it as a movement. And then you mentioned the conflict of interest narrative. Can you describe what you mean by that? I mean, why do you think it's a movement, or what is the narrative? Exactly.
Sure. Well, one of the things I try to explain to people in the book is that despite the emphasis that you hear of how the problems of healthcare, access issues, cost issues, it's incredibly better since I started out almost 50 years ago. And I'm sure your listeners know the fact that we live 10 years longer, we're 60% less likely to die of a heart attack. We just don't see people crippled up with arthritis the way we used to when I started out. And as I mentioned before, this is entirely because of these amazing tools that we get from industry. And then there's the expense and difficulty that I alluded to. Now, the conflict of interest, I call them instigators, basically deny these facts. They say they're made up. And that particularly that when physicians or researchers work with industry for pay, they lose concern of their reputations and they do flawed research or they harm patients. And I try to set that straight in the book. And so that denial and those allegations, that's the conflict of interest narrative. And I frankly think it's a myth, and I try to prove that point in the book.
Okay, but you know, people who have an interest in the conflicts that might occur between industry and physicians, I think that's mostly what you're talking about. I don't think they're denying that the industry has done tremendous good. Don't you allow for some of these instigators, you call them, don't you allow that they might have a point, there might be a few bad apples in there that need to be regulated and made sure that they don't continue to destroy the reputation of the industry?
I mean, I go through the incidents and the allegations, and let's just take the incidents. The incidents, it started with research, and so there's what I call canonical incidents that the media picked up. What's striking at first is that there's so few of them. There's thousands and thousands of interactions between physicians and the industry that are neutral or positive. And I should also say, contrary to what you said, many of these people do deny that industry adds value. It just makes Me Too products. Oh, as I hope we'll talk about, there's the smoking gun, those huge settlements that are absolutely diagnostic for corruption and criminal activity. And some of these people had held very prominent positions in medicine. They didn't have any industry experience, but that's what gave these myths credibility. Any enterprise as large as the industry medicine interface is going to have bad apples. But the way we handle bad apples, for the most part in society, is when somebody commits a crime, we think they commit a crime, we investigate, and if we can convict them, then we punish them. That's not what's happened in this conflict of interest arena. We have rampant prophylactic law. It's as if you weren't allowed to drive a fast car rather than being pulled over for speeding. And so there is a whole run. Now, this gets us into the marketing area, which I think is of greatest interest to your constituents. We've had a series of bans that are intended to limit access of company representatives to doctors. We've had banning of samples, banning of trivial trinket items that are common in our general economy. And we can talk about the cleverness of that strategy and what is used to justify it. Many, many practices now ban visits by representatives. That's really bad for education, and I'm sure your listeners are aware of this.
So you're saying that the narrative has been pretty successful and that many medical schools and physician practices have, banned certain things because they feel that they agree with the conflict of interest instigators. So can all those people be fooled all the time, or...
It sure has worked out that way, and I use the term the instigators. I also talk about enabler enforcers, and the enabler enforcers should know better, but the fact is that one of the other big changes in medicine over my lifetime is it has become incredibly bureaucratized, and it's probably unavoidable. It's become a huge business, and the sort of shabby genteel very academically oriented enterprise that it was when I started has now converted into it's predominantly a service and exercise. And sure, there's still a lot of research that gets done, and the administrators pay lip service, and they in fact talk the talk over we must work with industry to advance technology. But the fact is, they don't walk the walk. That their principal concern is to avoid scandal. And when you have prominent academics and the New York Times and other media and politicians. And not to mention another major class of instigators are the lawyers, because they win no matter what. They win if they prosecute you. They win if they defend you. They win if you have to hire them for compliance. And that's a perfect storm. And so the administrators say, well, gee, you know, the biggest threat to my job isn't if nobody discovers or develops anything. It's if there's a scandal. And that's why they've rolled over for these regulations. Fact is, in the 30 years that this has been going on, there have been no serious reputational issues.
Well, let's talk about a specific issue, and has to do with the payments to physicians, which I think you've written a lot about. And the that seems to be a big victory for the conflict of interest movement. And you've said that the Sunshine Law, this law, implemented in 2013, fully embodies the spirit of the conflict of interest mania. It is clearly intended to limit, if not abolish, all payments from industry to physicians. This pressure to ban everything has the potential to dampen innovation and impair the exchange of information about new medical products. But do you think this law, I mean, I interpreted the law to mean that this is a transparency where, well, if you're proud of the industry and you're proud of the work you do for the industry, why shouldn't you be transparent about the monies that you receive from the industry? But do you think this, the industry should fight this kind of transparency? For example, a section of the 21st Century Cures Act, which is in the Senate now, I believe, would exempt the pharmaceutical industry from reporting a major section of payments to physicians, i.e., those payments in relation to continuing medical education programs. And I'm sure that the drug industry is happy to support that section of the act. Can you give us your opinion on that act and what's going on there?
Sure. Well, there's a lot of material there. So let me back off and let's start with where did this come from? So actually, in terms of the conflict of interest instigated, it was extremely clever. I mean, it was really low-hanging fruit. Medicine has a long, complicated history. For most of its existence, it could do nothing for people. And so physicians, such as they were, had very low status. And so they tried to raise their status by pretending to be priestly. They wore robes. They did Latin and Greek. Didn't work very well. You know, the priests didn't have to prove they got you into heaven, but it was all too obvious that the doctors weren't saving lives. And even when finally, thanks to science, the doctors could start to do things, there was lots of sects fighting with each other in medicine. There was the patent medicine industry. And then finally, about the middle of the last century, when mainstream medicine won out, there was no reason to unload this priestly stuff. So there, you still have a lot of moral bullying that medicine is a calling. Industry only cares about profits and doctors put patients first, whatever that means. So, I mean, what I mean by this hung in your duck is that you graft now onto this priestly stuff that reps are given doctors mugs and sticky pads, or they're go doctors when they go to talk to other doctors are going to nice restaurants and say, oh my God, you know, this is corrupt, this is bad. And you know, who's going to fall on their sword for pens and sticky pads? And so they got their foot in the door. But the problem there is now you've admitted you have a corruption problem in the industry. All the ethics codes say no more gifts. Well, gee, now they're going after the big stuff. Well, they're still focusing on the small stuff, because the Sunshine Act says any payment in cash or kind of $10 or more has to be reported. Why? Where does this $10 come from? Well, again, it's this idea. It is if you ask the instigators, say, oh, because social science research has proven that small gifts cloud judgment. Now, if you ask them, what is that social science research? Most of the time, they won't know. And I'll tell you what it is. It's psychologists having college students play games, guessing how many coins there are in a jar, and that somebody else is incented financially to make the person guessing ramp up the guess. And this happens, and then the professor tells the advisor to disclose to the guesser that they're being paid to mislead the guesser, and the guesser still ramps up their guesses. Now, the point is, who cares how many coins there are in a jar?
There have been studies about real prescribing habits of physicians, and it's been a controlled study. Those physicians who are receiving gifts and those who did not, I mean, showed some differences there. So it's not just the psychologist.
You have that to show me. I've looked at this very carefully. I mean, the idea that reps come in and talk to you about a product that you're going to prescribe it, I mean, that's not rocket science. The question is, what is totally lacking is patient outcomes. So I'm sorry to go on so long about the $10 thing. I mean, the point is that problem with the Sunshine thing is it's costing billions to do that reporting. It's inaccurate. And transparency, and so that's diverting precious resources from research.
Wait a minute. In the book, you said it costs $400 million or $800 million. Where did you get billions from? I'm sorry.
Because it's the estimates, those estimates come from the CMMS, and they're lowballed because you have to account for the rep's time that they are spending keeping track, and the legal costs of figuring out the legal gibberish in the law about who actually has to report what. Transparency is great. It's great sounding, but the fact is, what do you do with the information? You got 10 minutes to spend with your doctor. You want to talk about your symptoms, or you want to talk about who's paying your doctor? What it's predominantly been used for is to shame. And you know what you said before about doctors ought to be proud of their industry associations. Yeah, that'd be great. But doctors, I find, tend to be thin-skinned, they're very shy. And so that this was of, and particularly the abuse they take. There's one particular outlet called ProPublica, which has been in this business. They reported that that physicians who were paid by industry had been reprimanded by their state boards. On the national TV show, the reporter said hundreds, well, 250 actually, out of 17,700. That's actually three times lower than the national average of doctors being reprimanded by their state boards. Getting industry payments seems to be a pretty good test for probity.
Okay, let's move on a little bit. In your book, you say that the drug industry has been forced to pay fines for marketing behavior that has caused no damages. These fines have been a result of major lawsuits against the pharmaceutical industry that have been settled. Would you care to comment on that?
As I was early on, and I'd read about these things, I'd say, oh my God, this isn't helping me. These companies doing this bad stuff. And then I read chapter 3 of Harvey Silverglade. He's a civil liberties lawyer's book called 3 Felonies a Day, how the feds attack the innocent. And I was blown away because then for the first time I understood what this really was. So and I find it's never explained in media reports, and I think in fact and most audiences I talk to don't understand. So bear with me and I'll try to explain it in as user-friendly a way as I can. So the 1960s Key Farber amendments that, you know, was the last that forced the industry had to prove efficacy of its products. The most aggressive regulators wanted the FDA to regulate prescribing. Needless to say, organized medicine wasn't happy with that. So the compromise was this thing that doctors can prescribe any approved, let's say, drug for. As long as it's approved for something, they can prescribe it for anything else off-label. Mm-hmm. Okay. The company, however, cannot promote off-label. Now, in the 90s, because off-label prescribing has become very common, there's some wiggle room was afforded, but it's fairly limited. Now, as you might imagine, you know, what's on the label is often gray areas, and so the companies might push the envelope, and for most of the past history, the FDA would slap them down. But then about a decade ago, a clever prosecutor figured out that you could use what's called false claims litigation in this area. So what false claims is different from standard litigation for three reasons. One is that the whistleblower who reports that this is going on gets 20% of the take. The second difference is there's treble damages, three times damages. So the prosecutors make an indictment, seal it up, and let it sit for 10 years. Nobody can see it. And while the sales build up, which that's why the fines get to be real big. So what's the case, actually? Remember, it's the false claims dates back to the Civil War. It was to go after contractors who bill the government for stuff they didn't do, for not doing the tasks they were supposed to do. And in this case, it's not the doctor, it's not the company that's making the false claim, it's the doctor. The doctor's writing the prescription. But the prosecutors don't want to go after the doctors because they don't have the big bucks, so they go after the companies. And the case they'd have to prove in court is that it's the company's invidious marketing that forced the doctor to write that prescription. And here the conflict of interest narrative comes in big time. All the lavish meals and this and that, gifts and all that kind of stuff. Now, the idea that you could easily win a case like that when you've got trained, educated physicians who are getting all kinds of information is really small. So why do the companies always settle? They always settle. And that's the third difference between false claims and regular litigation. It's something called debarment. So when I talk to people, I say, do you know what debarment is? You mean disbarment? No, debarment. Debarment means your company cannot do business with the federal government for any of its products. That means Pfizer, Merck, GSK can't sell drugs to Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, SCHIP. That's capital punishment. And that's why these cases always settle. Like I said, you never see this in the media reports, and you don't certainly see it in the medical literature either. So this is really pretty poorly understood, that it's basically a prosecutorial extortion racket. But
okay.
It's arguably the biggest damage, done the biggest damage. It's got that's what's got the industry on its heels. That's why there has been such a ramping back of interactions with physicians, because the physicians don't want to be shamed, and the companies don't want to be the sticker shock of these huge settlements.
What about the off-label promotion itself from the pharmaceutical industry? Are you saying that the pharmaceutical industry, you know, should be able to promote the off-label use of their products if there's any evidence to support that without any interference from the FDA or the government?
Well, fortunately, that the answer to that question is above my pay grade, but it's important. And I think the one place where the only place where there's detailed discussion of this issue is actually in the legal literature. There are many, many law review articles that say these prosecutions are terrible. It's penalizing people for truthful speech. But these articles also come up with various suggestions of ways the FDA could address I think we agree. I don't think that there should be rampant off-label prescribing. I think or off-label promotion. I think that companies should be obligated to go through the hoops of testing in the standard way as much as possible. On the other hand, there are mitigating circumstances. I think that if it gets good products to patients sooner, reasonable people should be able to come to some kind of an understanding. And all I'm saying is, when we have that discussion, it shouldn't just be the anti-industry cranks. It should be people who really understand the economics and the safety issues. And I'm not holding my breath, but it would be nice if we could go in that direction.
Well, we can talk a lot more about that, but let's get on to your recommendations for what is to be done. And I think one of your suggestions is to recruit key opinion leaders to, have a narrative that is the antithesis of the conflict of interest narratives. And you're saying companies should recruit as many of these partners as they can, and they should especially seek out individuals with influence in their professional organizations. I noticed that, Amarin is a pharmaceutical company that's suing the FDA over this free speech off-label issue, and they did have several physicians' comments within their case against the FDA. So the industry is doing that.
Yeah, I just recently saw that. I just read the suit, and I'm still processing it. But yes, that's true. I mean, but let's go back to that you mentioned this amendment where they're talking about excluding educational materials in the 21st century cures from reporting. I mean, it's related to this. The reason that this amendment is incubating is because it's people who have skin in the game. There's a financial issue there. So on the one hand, you have the medical education industry that is being hit by this reporting, and so they want to be excluded from that. And believe it or not, the medical journals, the top tier medical journals, make a lot of money selling reprints to companies. And the docs don't want those reprints because they show up on their sunshine reporting. And so this is killing the journals. So the journals were in their full court press pushing for this.
I understand your point of view that the special interests, like the journals and the medical education companies, may be lobbying for this. Is that what you're implying? And
absolutely.
Not necessarily
absolutely.
The pharmaceutical industry? Okay. Okay, but
and they believe they add value. I mean that it's all at the end of the day. It's about value and patient benefit, and so. But on the other hand, it's just a fact of life that it's driven by economics, and so
the pharmaceutical industry also pays speakers and other. Aspects of continuing medical education, and you yourself noted that used to be, and I guess going back to 2006, 50% of all CME income came from the pharmaceutical industry. Now it's down to 30%, and I think you're attributing that to the conflict of interest movement. Do you see any this kind of change in the law, the Sunshine Law, helping that situation or changing that situation?
No, I think that's predominantly a result of these prosecutions that These things are very complicated. I mean, sometimes it's because products have gone off patent, and so the company companies no longer have an interest in supporting education in a particular area. Some companies have ramped back on the so-called promotional speaking for that reason, while others do a lot of it. I mean, that's another activity that's demonized. It gets that the people who do a lot of it show up as big earners in the Sunshine Reporting, and ProPublica goes after them. That's too bad, because if they do a lot of it, it probably means they're good teachers. And so, and doctors vote with their feet. They love to go to those kinds of sessions, because in contrast to going to a big meeting or a grand rounds where the practitioner sits in the back and the academics sit posture in the front, and what the practicing doc really wants to be able to do is ask the expert, ask the speaker, I have a patient with this, I have a patient with that, what would you recommend? And that's the great value of these intimate kinds of things. And then, the fact that they were in restaurants, where is it written that the education in the monastery, sitting on a bed of nails, is better than education in a restaurant? Most of our networking in our economy is done under pleasant circumstances. I don't see what's wrong with that.
Okay. I think we have time for one more issue under what is to be done, because I think you mentioned getting patients involved, patient advocates involved in curing the Rodney Dangerfield syndrome that the pharmaceutical industry has. You're saying that the industry should focus on groups, people with diseases or whose families have diseases that they want to have prevented, better managed and cured, to enlist these people to get involved in the so-called anti-conflict of interest movement. Can you cite examples of how the drug industry may already be doing this? I seem to recall that there have been cases where there are grassroots patient advocates protesting in front of Congress when a certain bill is being thought about. So isn't that already happening?
Well, the industry has taken very much, it's been tactics rather than strategy. I think patient groups are mobilized, to help approve drugs or to avoid price controls. But the problem is that the threat of price controls, the device taxes, are part of the conflict of interest narrative. If these people have succeeded in convincing politicians that the industry exaggerates the difficulty and cost of getting products out, sure, tax them, control the prices. And I think that is the big picture strategic issue people need to understand. I tried to put it all in my book. I hope it's user friendly, because I find it, as I said before, even educated people don't know much about this. I hope I'll get feedback that people will tell me if I succeeded. I think education is a big step. Understanding, this is about your health. This is what's going to be how we're going to get a cure for Alzheimer's. I don't know how to make it easier, but we shouldn't be making it harder. And we are making it harder. Here's why. I think only industry has the resources to mobilize this kind of thing. I think they have to stop being so deferential and politically correct. That's not how our politics works. And it needs somebody, I'm sympathetic to the people in the industry, because they have such a huge enterprise, they have so many things to do, but someone ought to get up to speed and make this a full-time job to figure out how to, whether it's at the level of the trade organizations or individual companies, probably the former. I haven't seen, there's been very little of that. I think that's what needs to be done. Don't know if it'll succeed in my lifetime, but I'm an optimist.
Okay, well, that seems like a good point for closing, unless you have something that you did not talk about you want to say in closing. Do you have any other comments you'd like to make, Tom?
I think we've covered a lot.
I
would just say you can get the book at Amazon or at the publisher, Roman Littlefield. Give me feedback.
Okay. Well, thanks for being a guest and talking about Pharmaphobia, your book. And thanks to my listeners for listening in. And this is Pharma Guy saying goodbye until next time. Bye, Tom. Thanks for being a guest.
Thank you, John. Much appreciated.